Good morning to you all. My name is Mike Kay. I'm the editor manager for Still Human, Still Here, and I'll be moderating the next session. And we have an excellent panel of speakers for you this morning, and they're all going to be giving you different perspectives on social exclusion and what we can do to counter it. So I'll introduce them very briefly before they speak, but what we'll do is aim to finish early enough to have 15 minutes of discussion and comments from you all. So without further ado, let me introduce the first speaker, Frances Trevenor, Head of Policy and Programmes at Coram Children's Legal Centre, and she's going to be looking at the problems generated by limited access to legal aid. Frances.
So first, a tiny bit about Coram Children's Legal Centre, because people might not know masses about what we do. It is the only centre in the UK that exists to promote and protect the rights of children, and there is an international part of our team who go abroad and do some work internationally on children's rights. There is a legal practice unit with legal aid for immigration, community care, family law. And then we have a migrant children's project which works specifically on the rights of migrant children and their families. And we run a free telephone advice line that operates nationally, and we run training capacity building nationally. So I've put some leaflets outside with our advice line, which is email and telephone, so if people want to ever ask questions, we are there and you can do so. But we've long raised concerns about legal aid, and particularly about the limited access to justice for children, for families, following the LASPO Act in 2012. And what LASPO did was take out areas where previously legal aid had been accessible and put in those parts of legal aid that they were required to give by virtue of the UK's international obligations or, in fact, our EU obligations. So there's always a bit of a concern when we look towards the referendum that legal aid access could be limited even further. Immigration legal aid is generally available for asylum claims, but it's subject to a means and a merits test, which means what we found is that individuals may find their legal aid withdrawn at key moments in their cases. They might have legal aid to present their initial asylum case, but on appeal they might find they lose access and they're left to prepare their case themselves. The detained fast-track litigation that resulted in the suspension of the fast-track, and the Home Office are absolutely determined that fast-track is coming back in some form or other. One of the key points that was raised was that for a lot of individuals on the fast-track, because they couldn't access their additional evidence, their lawyers were dropping the cases, so legal aid was not covering them for their detained appeal, and that was a key point of unfairness. Even now, when people are released pending their appeal, it's still an issue about what happens, who's helping them prepare. And the Poppy Project, which some of you might know, which was an anti-trafficking project specifically for women, intervened on one of the detained fast-track cases, and they put together all of the cases of victims of trafficking who had been involved or had been detained as part of the detained fast-track. And they discovered that almost all had been dropped by their lawyers as a result of not meeting the merits test for legal aid. And in fact, one of the very few women who had still secured legal aid for her appeal only disclosed that she was a victim of trafficking on the morning of the appeal to the lawyer representing her, because it was the first opportunity she perceived that she was free of a detention setting and she was free of the control of police officers, of her traffickers, and of officials in detention. So it's really key that legal aid is available and that independent source of advice is available for individuals. Other aspects of legal aid that are available for immigration include for domestic violence applications, but they are very specific. So it doesn't matter if you are a victim of domestic violence who is in the UK as a foreign national. You have to be a victim of domestic violence who is in the UK as the partner or spouse of somebody who is British or settled. There is also a matching European right, but you need to go through a family law process first. And so the chances of being able to access the immigration legal aid are really limited by not being able to access the family legal aid. And so it's very hard to see how those pieces slot together. And identified victims of trafficking have access to legal aid. And this is a result, like I say, of the EU directive on trafficking. And so there are questions over what happens if we leave. Someone just said, oh God, I know. It will be so much worse. I can guarantee, because we have exceptional case funding. The idea of exceptional case funding is that if your case raises issues that might result in a breach of your human rights, or it might result in a breach of other European rights, then you can apply for exceptional case funding. But in the Home Office has already told us that for immigration cases, they don't raise issues of fundamental importance in the same way as asylum applications, where the issue at stake may be literally a matter of life and death. But what that ignores is for a lot of people who claim asylum and who fail, it is actually ultimately as a result of other aspects of their case that they secure leave to remain in the UK. And we have got some statistics about exceptional case funding. Originally, when it came out, for the first year, your chances of being granted exceptional case funding hovered around 4%. It's gone up, so for the last quarter that we have statistics, it was 52%. But what that hides is the extremely low number of applications that are being made, around 1,200 a year for all categories of legal aid. So that includes inquests, includes family law, it includes immigration. Prior to that, or when LASPO first came in, what we saw was a drop of first stage legal aid advice by about 100,000 cases. So if you compare that 100,000 cases that were taken out of the system with the 1,200 that are now applying for exceptional case funding, of which around half are granted, you see that we've got a real issue with access to legal aid and therefore with access to justice. And one of the things I think that really illustrates this is a case of a woman who I dealt with, who we'll call Mavis. Mavis was from Nigeria, and she was a teacher, so she was away from her home for large chunks of time, and she'd come back at weekends. She came back one weekend to discover that her village had been burnt. She didn't know where her husband was, she didn't know where her child was. All she was told was that there had been sectarian violence. She was in a Christian village. This was about 15 years ago. And she applied for a visit visa to come to the UK because she was scared, she couldn't find a family, she didn't know where she was supposed to go. She was marked as Christian wherever she moved around. And of course, when she got here, she claimed asylum. And what she was told was, there is no sectarian or religious violence in Nigeria. Anyway, we don't believe it happened to you. And even if it did happen to you, which we don't believe, you could go and move to another part of the country where you'd be safe. So, a fairly standard asylum refusal there. And she disappeared, she went underground for a while. She met somebody who said, I can sort out a visa for you, come and work for me, and I'll sort out a visa for you. Give me your passport. So she did that, she handed over her documents, and she carried on working for him. Every 6 months she said, how's it coming along? I know it's coming, don't worry, I'll get you your documents. And then about a year or two later, she spoke to him again, and he said, I don't know who you are. I don't know who you are, I don't know what you've asked of me, I have never agreed to help you. So there she was, with no documents, no visa, no status. And when I met Mavis, she'd been living in a car park in Lambeth for the last 4 years on and off. And here's the problem. She's failed in her asylum claim. She feels extremely British. She's spent a long time here. She said to me, I've eaten British food and I've walked on the street, so how can I not have a right to be here? To get her exceptional case funding, we have to work out what applications have already been made in her name. So there's a huge amount of work to do for free there, making applications to the Home Office to find out what had happened previously. Had there been another application? Where were her documents? And then putting together a case which said, well, these are the exceptional reasons and this is why she needs funding to pursue her case. And then finally finding the lawyer who would be able to take the case on. So all of that we set out to do, and very quickly it became clear that Mavis didn't have capacity to instruct. She didn't really know what was going on. She couldn't give me clear instructions, and she couldn't tell me clearly what happened to her. And you know what? In that case, there is nothing you can do. There is no safety net. There is nothing that lawyers can do, because exceptional case funding does not cover people who lack mental capacity, and that is a huge issue with how we treat asylum seekers and those who fail in their asylum cases initially.
Thank you very much. Very clear. You can save the applause to the end, it'll get through faster, I think. The next one up is Dave Smith. He's the founder of Bowers Trust, and he's currently heading up NACOM, which is the No Accommodation Network. And Dave's going to talk about destitution. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah. I'm going to come up here because I can't see around the corner. I'll be doing that all the time. Yes. The in technology is wonderful. I plugged in my iPad this morning because I forgot the charger yesterday, and it's gone down from 5 to 2%. So it's taken it out, so I might have to go back to this. But okay, four things I'm going to have a look at this morning very, very quickly. Talking about destitution, first of all, how does it happen? And then how many destitute asylum seekers are there in the UK? How do people cope with destitution and what can we do about it? Hopefully I'll get through that in 10 minutes. First of all, I'm sure most of you know this already, so excuse me for sort of stating the obvious, but primarily it's people who've gone through the asylum system, whose claims have been refused, and at that point they've got 3 weeks to leave their accommodation. They get one final asylum benefit payment, £36 something, and after that they have no recourse to public funds, which means they have no right to work, no benefits, no housing. It also includes now people who, temporarily at least, people whose claims have been successful. They've got the refugee status and they have to be out of their accommodation in 4 weeks. And because there is no actual link-up between the DWP and the Home Office, they just don't talk to each other as far as I can see, it takes on average 6 to 8 weeks for somebody to get their refugee status properly documented, to get their NI number, to get their benefits coming through, and by that time they have to be out of their accommodation. So, and if you don't have much money, which they don't have obviously, you don't have money for a deposit, because you probably can't get into any sort of accommodation apart from possibly hostel accommodation, if you're lucky, and then you have to go private. But can you go private if you haven't got a deposit? No, you can't. So last year at Boaz Trust in Manchester, we have a night shelter there for 12 men, and it's for destitute asylum seekers. And last year, 20% of the people that used it were refugees because they had nowhere else to go. So they are also temporarily destitute. And in the future, it's very likely that there are going to be a number of families that are destitute, because some families are being given discretionary leave to remain with no recourse to public funds. And if you're a woman with small children, how on earth can you look after your children at home and work at the same time? You can't, even if you can get a job. So we're going to have families that are going to be destitute as well, and then the local authorities will either have to take the children into care, or they're going to be on the streets with their parents or parent. So that's going to happen in the future. So that's sort of how it happens at the moment. How many people are there? Well, nobody actually knows the exact numbers, partly because the advice centres have been, their funding has been slashed. So Refugee Action, for example, a few years ago in Manchester, they used to open on 3 or 4 days a week and have long queues of people coming in for advice. And then the funding was cut, so it all went. And there's very little left now. So people don't have access to the advice, so they're not getting referred to the right places. So often when people are made destitute, you don't actually find out where they are. They can go to Red Cross destitution services, destitution projects, drop-ins and things like that. A conservative estimate I heard last year was something like 50,000. And that number is actually going up every year, because Despite Home Secretary saying for the last 10 years we're going to deport more people because the system's not working, they haven't done it. They just cannot deport the number of people they want to deport. 50% of asylum seekers are refused asylum after appeal, and we don't deport that number of people every year. So the number goes up and goes up until at some stage the government has to do something about it, and there's some sort of, hopefully some sort of amnesty, which is not called an amnesty and doesn't come in the numbers, like the last legacy programme. We also know that destitution is beginning to happen outside of the bigger cities, because now that the accommodation providers are accommodating people in smaller towns, where it's cheaper to house people than in some of the bigger cities, then in those towns there's going to be destitution happening as well when it gets to the point where people are being refused. So it's going to be happening in some of the smaller towns as well. The good news is that many of these smaller towns are actually getting geared up for this now. There are projects beginning to start right from the beginning, because they know people are coming, they've been made aware because of the refugee crisis, and they really want to do something. So up in Lancashire, for example, Preston and Skelmersdale and places like that, where that are now getting asylum seekers, there are projects already gearing up. And they're going to be doing something about destitution as well, I'm sure, in the next few months. So how do people actually cope with destitution? I recommend a report that Oxfam wrote in 2011, which is called Coping with Destitution. It's an excellent report. It goes through all of the things that people do when they're made destitute and homeless. Initially, many people will try and stay on where they are in asylum accommodation, even though their locks will be changed. They might try and stay on the sofa. They might have a friend in there that might put them up in their room. If they've got friends, if they've been here long enough, they will be sofa surfing. They'll be staying with a friend for a few days here and a few days there. And it puts a strain on the relationship, because most of the people that they know will also be asylum seekers in the system, and you're not allowed to have people staying with you. So often relationships break down because of that. People will often lose their education. They can stay on in education if they're in education until the end of that term or the end of that course, and then there'll be no funding for it. But even if they are able to get there, because they have no bus fares, obviously, the fact that they're trying to cope with other things, they just cannot concentrate. I've met so many people that cannot concentrate on what they're doing because of their situation. So actually learning at the same time is almost impossible. They will be. Some will go to charities for handouts, to food banks, to destitution projects, and try and survive that way. And then what I would call trading. So somebody might do some babysitting for a friend in return for a place on the sofa or a little bit of money or something like that so the friend can go out to work. Or childminding, or cleaning, or whatever it is. And sometimes that becomes exploitative. Sometimes it's sex in return for a bed. People get into relationships they would never normally get into and wouldn't choose to get into because they think that's the only option. It's gone. There we are. On to the notes now. So that's how people cope. And then, of course, there's illegal work. And people that work illegally will not be getting a fair wage. They will be getting far less than the minimum wage. They'll be working in night security or the back of a restaurant, so that's where you can get nice cheap Indian meals, because the people that are doing the washing up, the car washes, you know, you can get a nice car wash for five or £7 for balloting or something like that. That's probably because of the people doing it, they're working illegally. And many asylum seekers will be in that situation. So what can we actually do about it? Well, I think the first thing is that if you want to get your head together to be able to do anything about your situation, first of all, you have to have somewhere to live. It's really difficult to think straight if you haven't got a roof over your head. So in the NACOM network that I coordinate, there's 38 organisations now from Brighton to Glasgow who are doing some form of asylum destitution accommodation. Last year we housed between 680 people, which is a tiny number compared to the number out there, but it's better than nothing. 280 of those were refused asylum seekers, some refugees and so on. This year it's going to be over 800, and it's going up year by year, so things are happening. Secondly, there's we've heard about legal advice, how important that is for people to get their cases back on. But, you know, Tim Finch said yesterday that there are some people who, and I agree with him with this, who are not genuine asylum seekers that claim asylum. But I've got to say, I've met very few of them. 50% of people get refused asylum. In my estimation, at least 90% of people who claim asylum are genuine asylum seekers. So 40% are being wrongly refused asylum and made destitute. And that's what we've got to change, basically. If we can tinker with the system, we can do great things trying to help people, but we've got to change the system. We have to have an inquisitorial, not an adversarial system, a system where people are not interrogated, but are actually listened to. One of the things that I hear more than anything from destitute asylum seekers is, nobody has ever listened to my story since I've been here. That's the main thing that people will say to you. We have to change things completely. We have to change the system. We have to change the mentality that has that system in place in the first place. When Wilberforce and others challenged slavery, they didn't try and get better slave traders who were nicer to people. And that's what we've got to do with this system. We've got to scrap it, start again, and treat people humanely.
To arms from Dave there. And now we'll move on to the next session. We're going to split this between two speakers. They're both from Amnesty International UK Asylum Justice Project. We're going to begin with Trevor Truman, who's going to talk on detention.
All right.
And then we'll move on to Aid Henderson, who's going to look at public attitudes and alienation. Trevor.
Thank you. Detention. One problem we have is that we're beginning to accept that detention of asylum seekers is normal or natural. We are beginning to take on this idea that it's an okay thing to do. And we've got to resist this with extreme vigour. We should never lose our sense of shock and outrage that in Britain we can detain innocent people. And this is the message that we should be pushing out. The UK stands out in Europe as the only country without a time limit for immigration detention. We detain between 8 and 10 times the number of people that Sweden and Germany do, despite them taking 3 or 4 times as many asylum seekers as we do, even before the Syrian influx to Germany. Several hundred people spend more than 1 year in immigration detention, and there are some who spend 2 or 3 years in immigration detention. Unlike if you're involved in a struggle in the country where you come from, where if you're detained because you're struggling against injustice or oppression, there is a purpose to you being in detention. There is a reason, and you can justify it to yourself. If you're in immigration detention, there is no cause or reason that you can really understand for it. And that is a great source of mental ill health. Combine that with the lack of a time limit. Even rapists and murderers have a time limit for their detention. Combine the lack of a time limit with this lack of cause and the fact that you're already a vulnerable person, having come fleeing oppression and possibly with a history of torture or abuse, then the situation is absolutely perfect for creating mental ill health. Prisons, ordinary prisons, are known to have a higher prevalence of mental ill health than amongst the ordinary population. I spoke to Dame Anne Owers just as she was leaving her post as Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons. She also inspected immigration removal centres as well as prisons, and I asked her, how would you compare the atmosphere in an immigration removal centre and that in a prison? And she said, it's far, far worse in immigration removal centres. All of us can remember somebody who is apparently permanently mentally scarred from having been in immigration detention. Most of us are probably aware of asylum seekers that have committed suicide sometime in our experience of the system. Did you know the coroners are not allowed to write asylum seeker on the death certificate? We do not know how many asylum seekers commit suicide in Britain every year. If a coroner writes asylum seeker on the death certificate, it is sent back to that coroner for him to write unemployed on that death certificate. This disgraceful treatment of people is only possible because of the hostility that's promoted and accepted by successive governments, especially the current government. Detention has never been proved to work. Alternatives to detention, which are being promoted by the Gatwick Detainees Welcome Group and Detention Action, run by Jerome Phelps, who's going to be here later, they have demonstrated that you can monitor people in society in a supportive way without losing track of them. Not one of the people that Jerome and his group have been following over the last 2 years has absconded. One of the 20 has been deported or has gone back voluntarily, and another one has committed a minor crime for which he's been punished. Oh, thanks. So, my message is remain outraged, be confident, although not complacent, because the movement, the groundswell of opinion is changing. We are approaching a tipping point. What we can do as activists is bring that tipping point a little bit closer so fewer people are damaged as much as they are presently. But a tipping point is certainly coming. However, we can accelerate that if we are active, and we can relegate this treatment of asylum seekers to the dustbin of history where it belongs. Thank you.
Trevor, Aidan.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks, Trevor. Okay, so I'm just going to first of all start off by just introducing the Asylum Justice Project briefly. The Asylum Justice Project was launched by Amnesty International UK in January 2015, specifically to focus on the domestic response to the refugee crisis, effectively getting our own house in order in this country about how we treat refugees and asylum seekers. And there are four strands to the Asylum Justice Project. One is the destitution of asylum seekers, as Dave has already reflected on. The fairness of the decision-making process, immigration detention, which Trevor has just mentioned, and finally, promoting a positive narrative of refugees in the UK, and that's what I'm going to focus on at the moment. The theme of this year's Refugee Week is encouraging welcome, and as part of that, we need to focus strongly on challenging the negative public narrative that runs through much of the discourse that's put out by the media. And I'm sure we all know what that negative discourse can consist of, and we'll get onto the specifics of that in a second. So much of our work is focusing on myth-busting, and there's two different types of strands of myth-busting here. One is the myths that as soon as asylum seekers arrive in the UK, they're put up in a penthouse suite at the Hilton, they're given a chauffeur-driven limo and massages three times a day. The other myth is the myth that the British public are generally anti-asylum seeker, and I do believe that is a myth. Trevor talked about a tipping point in public opinion that we are approaching at the moment, and I think that's very much the case. It wasn't the case around 10 or 15 years ago. If you remember back to the early 2000s, the political discourse, much of what was being said in the House of Commons, consisted of Jack Straw and Anne Widdecombe trying to outdo each other over who could have a more hostile reaction to the asylum system, and the terms like bogus asylum seeker were bandied around much more than they are now. However, there is still a strong line of anti-asylum rhetoric, which is often fueled by opportunistic politicians and a very one-sided press agenda. And I'm going to get on to what that, a couple of examples of what that press agenda regularly puts out, and they are the usual suspects at the moment. So first of all, a couple of stories from the Daily Express that I'm going to regale you with. In 2013, the Daily Express ran a story about a group of 130 asylum seekers who had been rehoused in a top hotel because they didn't like the food in the one that, in the previous one that they were in. In 2010, the Daily Express wrote a story in response to a judgment of the Supreme Court which said that gay asylum seekers should not be sent home and simply told to be discreet about their sexuality. The Daily Express's response to this was that all this would do would be to encourage bogus asylum seekers to lie about their sexuality for purposes of gaining refuge. The Daily Mail got a fantastic fall on this. A few headlines that they produced over recent years. 4,000 murderers, rapists, terrorists we cannot kick out. That was from 2014. Asylum, you should be worried. That was from July 2015. A swarm on our streets. That was from August 2015. German Jews pour into Britain. That was from 1938. So this is a consistency there. The risk here is that this is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And our challenge, really, is to create a strong narrative against this. It's a difficult one, and the main positive aspects are other genuinely well-researched public surveys about what this country genuinely thinks about asylum. In May, Amnesty International published a survey that involved 27,000 people in 27 countries. It showed that in the UK, over 75% of UK residents would accept refugees into neighbourhoods or their homes. This really shows that this negative press agenda is completely out of step with what a significant number of people in this country think. The UK is in fact the third most likely country, according to this survey, to encourage refugees and to extend their welcome after China and Germany, which were in the top two. And the other point to make is that last year over 50 UK councils successfully passed resolutions to accept Syrian refugees into their communities, Oxford being one. I'm just going to finish here just because I've been given my 2-minute warning by talking about what our challenge is within this. Our challenge is effectively to go beyond what our normal audience is when we address these issues. Trevor and I spent an awful lot of the year going around to different groups such as this, such as different Amnesty groups, talking about this, and it's fantastic to do that. It's great to put that message across and see so many people enthused. But our challenge really is to go outside of our comfort zone with this and to talk to our trade union branches, our faith groups, our educational establishments, and try and give something as a counter to this extremely toxic narrative that's put out by so much of the populist press, which do have enormous circulations. And that's something that we will be using to try and enhance this tipping point which we're coming to in public opinion. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very grateful to our speakers for sticking to time, which means we have 10 minutes for comments, discussion, questions. We have a roving mic. I open the floor. Woman over there.
It's an excellent question. I think it's wonderful that you were able to get the Daily Mail. I tell you what it is. It's the second most widely read newspaper in the country, next to the Sun. It would be great to get them on board too. It's an interesting point. I think the point that I was making about creating a counter to that narrative, is not going to come from The Guardian and the Huffington Post, because the circulations simply aren't big enough, and they are preaching to the choir on this. The question is whether it's possible to get publications like the Daily Express and the Daily Mail on board. I did mention that I read out a headline from 1938 that the Daily Mail had written against Jewish asylum seekers into the UK. It goes back further than that. The Daily Mail was launched in the 1880s. One of its first campaigns was against Irish immigrants into the UK. In the early 19th century, again, against Jewish refugees from Russia. So there's a line going over about 130 years of the Daily Mail's negative and often toxic reporting on refugees. If that can be turned around, that would be wonderful. I question whether it necessarily will. And I think the challenge that we have to do in creating that counter is to look towards what methods are used now in spreading a popular a positive discourse, and it probably doesn't come from the printed media. We don't live now in a world where printed media, thankfully, has quite as much power as it once did. And that trajectory, I think, is going to continue. So whilst I think the efforts to get traditionally hostile press on board is fantastic, I think probably a better way of doing that is to look to outlets such as social media and online resources, which is having an increasingly powerful voice in this debate and is undermining the previous homogenous power that the printed media had, and that can only be a good thing, really. So in answer to your question, I think if you can get the Daily Mail on board, fantastic. But what I would encourage people to do is to focus on those other forms of community media, as well as kind of going out into your communities and speaking to other civil society groups who may not be traditional advocates and supporters of it.
Thank you. I'm going to take all of the questions now. So if you've got any questions or comments, we'll take them all as a group and put them to the panel. Okay, good point. We need to mobilise people who are supportive as well as change the views of others. Okay, we've got two specific questions. I think, do you want to come back on the legal aid issue?
Yeah, happily. No, it's a huge issue that I think particularly outside of London, there are some really poor immigration practice. And in London, there are some spots that are reasonably all right. But it's a massive issue trying to refer cases out to decent legal aid providers. Even where you do, legal aid is so low that you do find providers kind of doing the minimum on cases. I don't know how we can change it, but I do think complaints are really key, because so many people are scared of complaining, they're scared it will impact on their case. They pay a lot of money as well when people are not getting legal aid. They're sometimes going to private providers and saying, oh, legal aid's terrible, pay me the money and I'll sort it out for you, which is appalling. And complaints to the legal ombudsman are really key to improving practice, and I think it's brilliant to have something that helps people and supports people to do that, because I've tried to do it on four other people, and I know it's a really long, difficult process, and on top of everything else, you're dealing with your asylum claim, you also don't want to deal with the complaints against your solicitor, but it's key, and I think if there's help with that, that's great. I was going to mention that Praxis Brighter Futures did a video recently for young people about what to expect from your asylum lawyer, and actually it's for everybody, because it sets out the very basic minimum you should expect, things like your advice in writing, any kind of fees that are going to come up that you're expected to pay, timescales, really basic things that people are not getting from their lawyers. The other thing is complaints to the Office of the Immigration Services Commissioner, because if people are giving immigration advice they should not be, that is a criminal penalty, and the Office of the Immigration Services Commissioner can also step in. So if people are getting advice from not solicitors or not barristers, other people, there's a criminal penalty, and you can step in, and you can get people that way. And also to build up your own networks of lawyers who you trust and who are good and who you can refer people to. That's key. If you as an organisation have a network, have lawyers, and sometimes you have to put a bit of effort in. I was at the Poppy Project, we had to put a bit of effort into training lawyers to understand some of the issues around trafficking, because we simply didn't have enough lawyers nearby, so we had to build the capacity of them. And if people are interested and they're prepared to do it, then you've kind of got an in there to try and improve practice.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to wind this session up. I'm very grateful to all of our speakers for sharing their experience and insights. Quick round of applause.